facing the big silver Super Bowl VI trophy, impassive as a museum director, fielding questions with technical, theological, thermoregular certainty, impervious to the demons that my senses told me were present in staggering numbers. I mean, where is it leading us, this obsession with being first, being best, being number one? Tampered transcripts at Ball High in Galveston, rigged soapbox derbies in Akron, highly subsidized 11-year-old Chinaman making a shambles of the Little League World Series. Bribes, kickbacks, burglary, perjury, Watergate. Had the monster of our pioneering escaped in the Rose Garden? It seemed to me that this preoccupation with being number one was rushing us toward the temple of false idols, and from there to the paranoiac's ward. I don't mean football or even sports in particular, I said. I'm talking about this country across the board, this thing, this passion, this belief that in the search for success, the means justify the end. Yeah, Landry knew what I meant. He had been challenged before, and I heard him expound his beliefs many times in interviews, press conferences, damp locker rooms, and Fellowship of Christian Athletes banquets. Take away winning, he had said, and you take away everything that is strong about America. But I wanted to hear him say it again. You're talking now about the negative side of winning, he began, and I fancied that there was a hitch in the toneless economy of his voice. Generally, achieving goals, which in many cases means winning, is really the ultimate in this life we live in. Being the best at whatever talent you have, that's what stimulates life. I don't mean cheating or doing things that are bad. That's the negative side. But here's the thing. What are the alternatives? If you don't believe in winning, you don't believe in free enterprise, capitalism, our way of life. If you eliminate our way of life, the American way of life, what is the effect? What are the alternatives? I said I couldn't name them all, but humility was probably one. Peace, joy, freedom from the stigma of failure. If this country had the same appetite for peace and brotherly love as it had for war and puritanical vengeance, if free enterprise was more than a code word for greed, we might become the beacon of the world that we imagine ourselves to be. Tom smiled his ice age smile. I had known him for 14 years, and we had had this discussion many times. Tom did not see a contradiction between the terms of pride and humility, any more than some politicians and military men see a rift in slogans like bombs for peace. Achievement builds character, he told me. People striving, being knocked down and coming back, this is what builds character in a man. The Bible talks about it at length in Paul, in Romans. Paul says that adversity brings on endurance. Endurance brings on character, and character brings on hope. Then hope, not joy, peace, or love. Hope is the ultimate goal. That's right, he said. Character is the ability of a person to see a positive end of things. This is the hope that a man of character has. It's an old cliche in football that losing seasons build character, but there is a great truth in it. I've seen very little character in players who have never had to face adversity. This is part of the problem we see in this country today. Young people who have never really had to struggle in life, when they do eventually face problems where they need to turn to character, it's not there. They turn to the alternatives, drugs, alcohol or something. Drugs, alcohol or something. I wonder what that something could be. Al Ward, the Cowboys' assistant general manager, who had known Landry since 1945, recalled that Landry's own life was a progression of goals: to make his team a mission, Texas High School, to make it the University of Texas, to make it with the New York Giants. But each time he reached his goal, Ward said, the kick wasn't there. Then he found religion. Now he is satisfied with life. Though he had been a Methodist since boyhood, Landry claims he didn't become a Christian until 1958, 2 years before he became the Cowboys' first and only head coach. I was invited to join a Bible study breakfast group at the Melrose Hotel in Dallas, and I realized I had never really accepted Christ into my heart. Now I have turned my will over to Jesus Christ, he explained. There's nothing unusual in getting off on Jesus or even using Holy Scripture to justify any act or event. But in coming to grips with the alternatives, that is, eliminating them, Landry seemed to have refined the narcotic qualities of Paul's definition of character. Landry was relaxed, and more than I had ever seen him, strangely relaxed, considering that it was less than 3 hours before game time, perversely relaxed for a man who detests small talk, and was now being bombarded with it. 30 minutes, my allotted time, had elapsed, and I hadn't yet mentioned football to the man who is supposed to be the finest brain in the business. Landry's cobalt eyes studied me, waiting for a question, and I tried to remember what had happened in the years since I saw him last. He appeared warmer, less regimented, even vulnerable. Why? Well, two things were obvious. The Cowboys had not repeated as Super Bowl champions, thus laying waste all that talk about a cowboy dynasty. And 15 of the 40 players who did win the Super Bowl had been traded or forced into early retirement. Unlike previous champions, the Giants, the Packers, the Colts, the Cowboys weren't waiting for the skids. They were rebuilding while they were still near the top. But there was something else. Something Cowboys President Tex Schramm mentioned earlier. We were talking about the criticism that Landry treats his players like so many cards in a computer file. Schramm said, "You have to remember, Tom is a very honest, straightforward person. He's not a con artist. He treats his players like adults. Some coaches sell their players a bill of goods. You've seen it. They just stop short of holding hands when they cross the street. And these coaches get away with it because their consciences don't bother them. Tom can't do that. I think one thing that happened last year was that Tom tried to adapt. He tried to have a double standard, even though it was against his nature. This year, there is one standard and everyone conforms. Tom has gone back to his original concept of gathering about him the type of players he likes." It is staggering, the roster of non-conformers who had gone down the drain: Dwayne Thomas, Tody Smith, Billy Parks, Ron Sellers, Dave Manders, and in years gone by, talents like Don Meredith, John Wilbur, Lance Rensel, and Pete Gent, to name very few. Landry lifted his eyes, and they vanished. Thomas was a landmark in Landry's experiment with the double standard. Thomas got away with things that in Meredith's times would have called for thumbscrews. There were those in Dallas' organization, players especially, who resented Thomas leading them to two consecutive Super Bowls almost as much as they resented not getting there without him last season. The official theory is the Cowboys paid last year for the sin of putting up with Thomas in two previous campaigns. Take the case of Billy Parks, heretofore for a good white boy with a sterling reputation as a pass receiver. In the aftermath of Dwayne Thomas, Parks insisted on wearing white football shoes and speaking out against the war. Once, he refused to play because his black friend Toddie Smith was hurt, and another time he took himself out of a game because his presence on the field was keeping a black receiver on the bench. Now they were gone, the non-conformers as well as the non-achievers, and Landry looked more relaxed than I'd ever seen him. You know the illegal smile, the one John Prine sings about? Landry wore what you'd call a legal smile. He told me, "I've come to the conclusion that players want to be treated alike. They may talk about individualism, but I believe they want a single standard. Yes, that belief is behind many of the trades we've made. If a player is contributing and performing the way he ought to, he will usually conform. Now, if he isn't performing well and not conforming to team standards either, he ought not to be around. We can put up with someone who's getting the job done as long as he'll conform. But we just can't get along with a player who doesn't conform or perform. No way." There is a common misunderstanding among football experts that the best team, the team with the most talent, wins. It is true that you don't win without talent, but in the National Football League, there are five or six teams of more or less equal ability. In those delirious hours after Super Bowl VI, when the Cowboys were drunk with victory and talk of the new dynasty rained down, Landry permitted himself a Virginia reel around the dressing room. Then he struck a note of caution. "The question," Landry said, "is will the Cowboys perform at the same level next year?" At the championship level, he said, there is a very narrow edge between winning and losing. You don't have to take much away from a team to keep them out of the Super Bowl. The hunger that makes a player work hard enough to win is inherent in some, but in others, it has to be built in. The edge comes from trying to achieve a goal. Once you've achieved it, it's very difficult to look back at the price you've paid and then make yourself do it again. At the bottom of the sweet cup of Super Bowl VI, Landry read the future. Though they were essentially the same team that won the Super Bowl, the 1972 Cowboys were found lacking. There's only one Super Bowl, and it's no disgrace not to get there. In recent years, only Vince Lombardi's Green Bay Packers have been able to repeat as champions. That is what hurt, the fact that Lombardi had done it. There had been no double standard at Green Bay. All-Pro guard Jerry Kramer once remarked, "Coach Lombardi treats us all the same, like dogs." Even before his death a few years ago, Lombardi was a football legend, a vain, volatile, uncompromising dictator, a living metaphor for number one. Could Landry afford to be something less? Not if he had character. It wasn't Jesus or Paul that Tom Landry had in mind when he did corrective surgery on the 1973 Cowboy team. It was Vince Lombardi. Lombardi and Landry were guiding forces behind the great New York Giants teams of the 50s. And when pro football climbed out of the coal yards into the affluent living rooms of America in the early 60s, they were major influences. Jim Lee Howell was the head coach of the Giants, but it was Lombardi's offense and Landry's defense that gave the Giants character. After Lombardi moved on to the head job at Green Bay and Landry took on the new franchise in Dallas, Howell resigned, explaining that 10 victories don't make up for 2 defeats. Lombardi was a much warmer person than Landry, says Wellington Mara, the Giants owner. He went from warm to red hot. You could hear him laughing or shouting for 5 blocks. You couldn't hear Landry from the next chair. Lombardi was more of a teacher. It was as though Landry lectured the top 40% of the class, and Lombardi taught the lower 10%. Landry was still a player coach when he designed the modern 4-3 defense, Pro Football's equivalent of the Doomsday Machine. Later at Dallas, Landry pioneered a method of combating that defense, the multiple offense. Landry was a born student of the game, says M. Tunnell, the great defensive back who played with and later for Landry. But he was kind of weird. After a game, the rest of us would go out for a beer. Tom would disappear. He was always with his family. You never knew what was going through his mind. He never said nothing, but he always knew what was going on. We didn't have words like keying, that is, reacting to prearranged schemes, in those days, so Tom made up his own keys and taught them to the rest of us. By training, Landry was an industrial engineer. He had a need to know what was going on. I couldn't be satisfied trusting my instincts the way Tunnell did, Landry explained. I didn't have the speed or the quickness. I had to train myself and everyone around me to key various opponents and recognize tendencies. Most of us just played the game, Frank Gifford recalls. Landry studied it. He was cool and calculating. Emotion had no place in his makeup. Another former giant, Dick Nolan, who went on to become head coach of the San Francisco 49ers, says, I remember one time Tom was at the blackboard showing me that if their flanker came out on the strong side on a third down play and the fullback flared to the weak side, I was to follow the fullback out a few steps and then race back quickly because they would be bringing the wing back inside me to take a pass. But Tom, I said, what if I commit myself that completely and the wing back isn't there? Tom just looked at me without any change of expression and said, he will be. Landry's reputation was constantly exposed to ridicule in the mid-1960s, not only because his Cowboys twice lost championship games to Lombardi's Packers, but because Landry himself came across as such a cerebral paradox, a rigid, humorless figure, stalking the sidelines of the Cotton Bowl in his felt snap brim and burial policy dark suit. Like the team he coached, Lombardi was purely physical, seething, kicking, pushing, openly humiliating those around him, and getting results. If the Packers were the bludgeons of pro football, the Cowboys were the slide rules. Paul Hornig once observed, Lombardi would be kicking you in the rump one minute and putting his arm around you the next. Landry would react to a great play or a poor play in the same dispassionate manner, as though it were ancient history. When a player was down, writhing in agony, the contrast was most apparent. Lombardi would be racing like an Italian fishwife, cursing and imploring the gods to get the lad back on his feet for at least one more play. Landry would be giving instructions to the unfortunate player's substitute. Landry once explained, "The reason I take on the appearance of being unemotional is I don't believe you can be emotional and concentrate the way you must to be effective. When I see a great play from the sidelines, I can't cheer it. I'm a couple of plays ahead, thinking." Lombardi's style of play was very different from ours. The Green Bay system of offense, we call it the basic system, was that you were going to run the power sweep regardless of what the other team put up against you. Run that play over and over until you could execute it in your sleep. It was all execution. So Lombardi had to develop the players to an emotional pitch, keep them doing their best all the time against a defense that knew what was coming. The Packers had to stay very high emotionally to win. Our system is different. We run a multiple offense and must take advantage of situations as they present themselves. Everything we do from every formation doesn't work against every defense. So we have to concentrate. We have to think. Our defense is also quite complicated. It depends on reading movements and formations and knowing where to go. Therefore, the nature of response from the sidelines must be very different. The players don't want to see me rushing around and screaming. They want to believe I know what I'm doing. Leroy Jordan, Dallas's middle linebacker, explains, Landry isn't a praising coach. He's a corrective coach. If you do something right, that's what you ought to do. He only talks when you do something wrong. If Tom says, damn it, you know something severe has happened. There were traces of empathy when the Packers referred to Vince Lombardi as Il Duce. Landry has been called old computer face, a description that has all but vanished with the non-conformers and non-achievers. Pete Gent used to say he could tell when Landry was mad. The muscles beneath the Landry's ears would pop out, and his eyes would sort of glaze. His normal method of discipline is to treat you like a number, Gent said. He seems to be concentrating on talking to you mainly to keep you from vanishing. Gent, author of the bitterly critical pro football novel North Dallas 40, read Dallas Cowboys, agrees with another ex-cowboy, Dwayne Thomas. Landry is a plastic man, and yet there is this paradox. In Landry's presence, you do not feel the cool platitudes of plastic and computers. You feel something more visceral. You feel fear. Meredith and other ex-cowboys have said the same thing. It is the fear that no matter how hard you try or how much you care, you will be found inadequate. Landry had read Gent's novel and didn't plan to, but he was aware of the general criticism. Big-time football is dehumanizing, brutal, and unfairly stacked on the side of management. In rebuttal, Landry said, "It's an amazing thing, this whole area of criticism. The one thing a player respects in a coach is that the coach makes him do what he doesn't want to do in order to win." Lombardi had great respect from his players, not because they liked him personally, but because he made winners of them. That is what all coaches are attempting to do, make players do things they don't want to do in order to achieve success. The people who usually level this sort of criticism, read Gent, are the people who didn't achieve. By Landry's code, you could stick Gent's ration of character on the back of a postage stamp. Gent was not a great player, but he hung around for 5 years. Landry never understood why Gent, Meredith, and others sat at the rear of the team meetings, laughing hysterically. Gent explains why in his novel. They were cracking and passing snappers of amyl nitrate. Gent once observed of Landry's playbook, "It's a good book, but everyone gets killed in the end." Gent's own book has already earned him more than $500,000. Non-achiever, indeed. Meredith, the honky-tonk hero, was a special case. From the beginning, he was the Cowboys' future. Coming off a brilliant career as an All-American quarterback at SMU, Meredith approached pro football as though he were Popeye saving olive oil from the cannibals. Meredith's quality was leadership, an ability to strike a spark of hope in the most hopeless situation. That is why he was called Dandy Don, a name Landry never appreciated. Meredith could rally a team from certain defeat, or splinter the sobriety of a practice session by perking off his helmet and threatening Cornell Green with bodily harm. He played it for laughs. The notion of Meredith threatening a headhunter like Cornell Green was beautifully absurd, and everyone appreciated it. everyone except Landry, who reminded the Cowboys in the meeting that night, "Gentlemen, nothing funny ever happens on a football field." I don't know if Landry ever saw it, but beneath all that tomfoolery and searching, Meredith was essentially the person he joked about, a good old East Texas boy, eaten up with talent and the Protestant vision of material success, fairly begging to excel and be recognized. Meredith endured against his own better judgment. He played many games when he could have rightly been in the hospital. Meredith's unhappy decision to slide into premature retirement came after Landry supplied an obstacle Meredith wasn't prepared to endure. Landry pulled Meredith from the 1968 playoff game with Cleveland and replaced him with Craig Morton. Ironically, Landry pulled Meredith for throwing an interception that should have been credited against Landry's disciplined system of play. According to Landry's gospel, the Cleveland defensive back who intercepted Meredith's final pass should have been on the other side of the field. Unfortunately, the Cleveland defensive back was in the wrong place. It wasn't that Landry was wrong. Cleveland just wasn't right. Meredith couldn't endure the consequences, the humiliation that, after all these years of enduring, he could be benched for non-achievement. When Meredith went to Landry, his pride crushed and personal problems weighing around him like a 90,000-ton infection, thinking that at last he had made the right choice, a choice that would please Landry, the choice to quit football, then Landry would stay in character and say, "Straighten up, don't do it. Forget it ever happened and smile tomorrow." Instead, Landry looked at him coolly and said, "Don, I think you are making the right decision." Landry contends that he was treating Don Meredith as an adult, respecting Meredith's right and ability to decide for himself. But given their relationship, a relationship Landry controlled, that was no way to treat Don Meredith. When I was a sports writer in Dallas, Meredith and I had this unspoken arrangement whereby he would tell me what I needed to know, and I would change his quotes to make both of us appear illiterate. Meredith had only one reservation to this agreement: watch out for my image, he would caution me after every interview. Meredith saw himself as a 13th century troubadour, persecuted for his good intentions. He saw Landry as the black monk, a creature who could swallow himself without changing form. If Landry understood the depth of Meredith's paranoia, he never let on. Sitting now across the desk from Landry, looking through the man and seeing my own reflection, I wonder, what image does Landry have of himself? I have been in many coaches' offices and observed that the decor is narcissistic. For example, the walls of Bear Bryant's office are papered with pictures of the coach and his team, the coach and his family, the coach and Phil Harris, the coach and his Buick. But there are only two pictures in Landry's office, a small gold-frame portrait of his family and the large autographed picture of Billy Graham looking down from infinity. Is it possible that Landry sees himself as a rock? I ask Landry if he thinks he has changed in the last 4 years, and he takes a long time to answer. "I've tried to," he says. "I think I've become more aware of people as individuals. I know the criticism that I look at my players as numbers, and I guess there's something to it. People my age, we grew up with the Depression, the war, a time of ICBMs and pinstripe suits and rampant materialism. But times are changing. I see that, and I make an effort to change too." Has Landry changed? I ask Clint Murchison Jr., the Cowboys' owner. "His hair's gotten shorter," Murchison says. "Anything else?" "Not that I know of," Murchison says. They are subtle, befitting their instigator, but the changes are there. There are fewer rules, veteran players tell me. Veteran players, though not rookies, can wear their hair any way they please. And with a few exceptions like Bob Lilly and Roger Staubach, most of them look like candidates for a drug raid. Landry personally sees to it that the word optional is printed on the schedule announcing the time and place of the weekly Sunday devotional. And the double standard, while officially reputed, exists as a practical matter. Just before training camp, Al Ward tells me, Walt Garrison asked Landry for permission to ride in a rodeo. Landry has strictly forbidden Garrison to rodeo, but of course Garrison does it anyway. But this time, when he asked permission, Landry just said, I don't want to know about it. In the preseason game against Kansas City, Landry did something that no one in the press box could remember seeing him do before. He walked over to an injured player and inquired about his health. What was it that Paul said again about adversity and endurance and character and hope? Hope for what? More adversity? I look at Tom Landry again, and now I know his self-image. Landry sees himself as a circle. So be it.
They combine the running of Tony Dorsett right there with, of course, the utterly brilliant passing of Roger Staubach. The thing about Roger is the way he diversifies his receivers. In the case you're looking at, the great tight end, Billy Joe Dupree. But Roger can hit anyone at any time. The other thing about Dallas is it's such a complete football team. On defense, the Cowboys are the NFC's leading sacking team with 25 on the season. This time, Bruce Thornton, the rookie from Illinois, doing it to Evans of the Bears. And when it comes to the secondary, the longest interception return executed by Randy Hughes of Dallas right there, 68 yards against the Cincinnati Bengals. But the fulcrum of the team, and always you get back to him, is Roger the Dodger Staubach, the NFC's number one rated passer.
Here's an article from the October 1977 issue of Texas Monthly entitled, The Aging of the All-American Boy. Roger Staubach at 35. Judy, the airport barmaid, was off for the weekend, but she showed no signs of leaving the lounge. She pressed against the wall-sized window and peered at the crowd in the lobby. "Geez," she said, "there they are. Look at the Dallas Cowboys. Look how big some of those guys are." A man at the bar chided Judy for gawking. "I can't help it," she said. "It's exciting. I never see anybody famous. Oh, look, there's Roger Staubach. He's the only one I recognize." Behind the bar was Judy's replacement for the evening shift. Several years older, Bonnie had nice legs and pleasant, skeptical eyes. Tilting a glass beneath the Coors tap, she asked Judy, "Who's the big team where you come from? Green Bay?" "Nah, nobody. Hey, look at Staubach. Now they're getting him to sign autographs." In a moment, Staubach walked by the window accompanied by a woman in a beige pantsuit and three young girls. He carried a suitcase in one hand and propped a blonde boy against his hip with the other, but his posture was unaffected by the burden. Chest out, shoulders back, all those years of military bearing. From the side, smiling, he looked like Burt Lancaster. "He's got kids," Judy observed. "Geez, look at all those kids." $1.05, Bonnie told her customer, placing the beer before him. She glanced at the quarterback and his family and reflected, "When you get to be my age, you start looking for proof of performance. If a man's got kids, it's a good sign." As a football player, Roger Staubach should have nothing more to prove. He was recruited after high school in suburban Cincinnati by more than 40 colleges. He was a junior college All-American at a military prep school in New Mexico. At the Naval Academy, he propelled the midshipman to a number two national ranking and won All-America and Heisman Trophy recognition as the top college performer of 1963. Staubach, the collegian, was a throwback to the heroic one-man gang era of Red Grange and Doak Walker. A roving gambler who passed and ran and threatened to score every time he touched the ball. He appeared to have little future in professional football because of his four-year obligation to the Navy. No service academy graduate had made a lasting impression on the National Football League. In addition, his style of play was out of fashion with the pros. The model quarterback of that day was a sturdy, stolid performer, preferably taller and heavier than the prototype John Unitas, who set up quickly and stayed put so his blockers could protect him. The only running quarterback of note in the pros was Fran Tarkenton, and he had a reputation as an exciting player whose teams didn't win. Staubach played no football for 2 years, then quarterbacked two seasons for a Pensacola service team organized just above the level of the Sandlots. Staubach's abilities not only survived that layoff. During his third pro season, he ousted Craig Morton, a drop-back passer and six-year veteran who had guided Dallas to its first Super Bowl the previous year. Staubach led the league in passing his first season as a starter. And more important, under his direction, a team renowned for its near misses finally claimed the championship. Since he joined the Cowboys, mobility has become one of the criteria for judging pro quarterbacks. As a leader capable of rallying his team from behind, Staubach may be the greatest quarterback who ever played the game. Yet, as the Cowboys returned from training camp to Dallas for their first exhibition game of the 1977 season, uncertainty nagged at Staubach. An athlete is old at 35. Born a few months apart in 1942, Mel Renfro and Staubach are now the oldest players on the team. As tissues age, they become more susceptible to injury, and they do not heal as quickly. Staubach's left shoulder has been dislocated 17 times. 5 exhibition seasons ago, Staubach tried to run over a linebacker and separated his right shoulder, an injury that could have ended his career. But he was throwing again 9 weeks after the operation. Staubach is no longer reckless. He still runs when the opportunity presents itself, but when he sees the tackle coming, he slides like a base runner as the haymakers whoosh over his head. Last year, he got off to a dazzling start, completing more than 70% of his passes. Then, of all things, he broke his little finger. He couldn't throw as well and lost strength because he had to discontinue weightlifting. As his statistical ratings slipped, the Cowboys' attack began to falter. Staubach was not altogether at fault. The excellence of his passing had veiled the mediocrity of the Cowboys' running game. Stalling and surging like a motor running out of fuel, Dallas coasted into the playoffs. Against Los Angeles, Staubach's passes nosed up and sailed incomplete. The Dallas defense provided ample scoring opportunities, but Staubach's unit failed to do its part, and the Cowboys lost to a team with a rookie quarterback. As a new season began, Staubach was under diminished pressure on the field. To the anguish of other championship contenders, the Cowboys drafted and signed Tony Dorsett by virtue of a complicated trade with Seattle. The moves of last year's Heisman Trophy winner are like the darts of a minnow. Cowboy scouts say the only running back prospect they ever rated higher was O.J. Simpson. With the Cowboys, Staubach has never suffered from the quality of his surrounding personnel. Yet his zeal for football can never again be carefree. For an athlete with his self-discipline, staying in shape is not the problem. His fears at this point concern the tendinitis that might develop in his throwing arm, the blindside tackle that could end it all. From now until he puts his shoulder pads away, Staubach will be trying to prove that he can still do the job. At $6 or $10 a ticket, NFL exhibition games are difficult to sell. Dallas exhibition opener against San Diego offered a continuing shuffle of starters, reserves, and rookies, a dress rehearsal for the regular season. The temperature at game time promised to be in the mid-90s, hardly an inducement for a large crowd. The angle hyped with greatest ardor in the promoting of the game was the rematch of Staubach and San Diego's Clint Longley. Baby-faced and curly-haired, Longley was the unknown kid from Abilene Christian who rallied the Cowboys past the Washington Redskins on Thanksgiving Day, 1974, after Staubach was injured. Unfortunately, that was Longley's only hour of Dallas glory. He rode the Cowboy bench, waiting for Staubach to yield again until last year's training camp when tensions between them exploded twice in 4 days. Worthy of a grade school playground, the first fight ended with Staubach sitting on Longley's chest. Longley then ambushed Staubach in the dressing room while he was removing his shoulder pads. Staubach spewed outrage and wore a Band-Aid over his eyebrow for a few days while the Cowboys traded Longley to San Diego, a frequent destination of Dallas castoffs. A year had passed since the fistfights, time enough for most hostilities to cool into indifference. Longley labored during the week behind a media screen erected by the Charger publicity director. "No comment," Staubach rebuffed the Dallas Times-Herald's Frank Lutze. "I don't care if he plays right tackle." Still, the telecast of the game opened with a split-screen juxtaposition of the two. "The big one tonight in Texas Stadium," intoned one Dallas radio voice. "The Cowboys and the Chargers, Staubach and Longley." The partial dome of Texas Stadium opens to the sky like the slot of a giant piggy bank. Viewed from the field, lights in the spectator sections are blurred, indistinct, except for the scoreboard, a broad splash of yellow and black above the north goalpost. The playing field is a belly-shaped swell of artificial grass. The crowd murmurs, bellows, and sighs, but most of the discernible noise comes from the players. During a Charger lineman early in the second period, Staubach threw long with most of his weight on the wrong foot. Shouts of alarm and glee erupted as Cowboy flanker Butch Johnson ran under the ball 50 yards downfield for Dallas's third touchdown. After the intermission, Staubach put his helmet on. He sat on the bench for some of the time, talking to Billy Joe Dupree, then knelt by himself and propped his chin in his hand. He stood up during the third quarter to watch the debut of Tony Dorsett, who excited the crowd for a few plays, then limped to the bench with a sore knee. Staubach hardly glanced at Longley. The most impressive quarterback was Staubach's current heir apparent, Danny White, who threw twice for scores to Drew Pearson. Longley played nearly three quarters and moved the Chargers no closer to a score than the Dallas 34. With no particular vengeance, Cowboy defenders knocked him down and intercepted his intended bombs for Johnny Rogers, the former Heisman Trophy winner from Nebraska. A fourth-quarter pass by a rookie named Cliff Olander and a punt return by Rogers spared San Diego the ignominy of a shutout, narrowing the score to 34-14. As Longley entered the tunnel to the visitors' dressing room, his glance toward the crowd was quizzical, apprehensive. Soon he shed his uniform and entered the shower, newsworthy in Dallas, no more. The spectacle of reporters begging profundities from men clad in athletic supporters places the term jock in sharper entomological focus. In the Dallas locker room, the most frenzied crowd of newsmen surrounded a young black man who bears a marked facial resemblance to comedian Flip Wilson. The Cowboys have never had a rookie player who excited as much interest as Tony Dorsett. perspiring, squinting at the television lights, explaining that he never promised he would gain 1,500 yards his first pro season. Dorsett was backed against the wire equipment cage by more than a dozen shoving, shouting reporters. Blackie Sherritt, the legendary Dallas Times-Herald sports columnist, watched that scene with an expression of fundamental weariness. Sherritt turned to Tex Schramm, the Cowboys' general manager, and they exchanged the smiles of old comrades in arms. "What about you, Tex?" Sherritt said. "You got anything to say?" Staubach walked by with a towel around his waist and grunted when Sherritt said, "Good game, Roger." He nodded at ex-roommate Leroy Jordan, who was visiting in the locker room after watching his first game in the stands as a retired player, then claimed a lavatory and mirror. He shaved quickly, pinky extended from his razor as if he were holding a wine glass. The notorious little finger of Staubach's right hand looks like it has been pounded with a hammer. It juts outward at a 45-degree angle, and the second joint is the size of a small pecan. He combed his wet hair back and put on a gold shirt and sans belt trousers. Except for the gang around Dorsett, the crowd in the locker room had begun to thin out. Staubach told a radio interviewer, "I don't think anybody resents all the attention Tony's getting. He's an exciting player. He's exciting when he makes 5 yards. But wasn't Dorsett under a lot of pressure?" Staubach nodded at the throng and said, "He's under that kind of pressure, but he's playing for a winning team. It's not like he has to carry the franchise." As Staubach moved away from the radio interviewer, a large man with a camera called his name. A second man with a parted afro and a blue business suit thrust his chest forward when Staubach halted beside him. Staubach turned his torso toward the man in the suit and provided the static grin of an experienced photographic model. The strobe flashed, Staubach's smile vanished, and he left the men without another word. Thousand Oaks, California is the ultimate suburb. 40 miles up the Ventura Freeway from Los Angeles, its main street is a landscaped boulevard served by 3 shopping centers, but no central business district. The roadsides are free of billboards and tall neon signs. The dry creek bed that winds through town has been paved. Avocado trees outnumber the oaks. Cool, soft air suggests the nearness of the ocean. Hills with broken horizons fade into the haze. The sidewalks of Thousand Oaks are filled with ambling retirees and jogging children. Beneath rock cliffs, where a Jap sniper extinguished John Wayne during the filming of Iwo Jima, is the modest, attractive campus of California Luther College, where the Cowboys have conducted training camp since 1963. After trying sites in Oregon, Minnesota, and Michigan, Tex Schramm talked about the team's camp facilities with his friend Glenn Davis, the ex-Army halfback and special events director of the Los Angeles Times. Davis told Schramm that a new college was under construction at Thousand Oaks, and the Cowboys became the first occupants of the dormitories. Told more often is the apocryphal story attributed to Don Meredith, in which Landry flew over the Conejo Valley, looked down and said, "Let there be a college." California Lutheran has been an ideal location for the Dallas camp. The weather in August is always fair and mild, and there's not much for the athletes to do in Thousand Oaks but play football. The week after the San Diego exhibition game, they had little time for anything else. There was a team meeting every morning, and though the Cowboys were in their 5th week of camp and had played well against the Chargers, the 2-a-day practice routine continued. The morning practice concluded at 11:30, specialty group meetings commenced at 1:30, and the Cowboys were back in pads from 3 to 5. After supper, they attended more meetings and watched more films, with perhaps 2 or 3 hours of free time before curfew. On Monday, after the Cowboys returned to Thousand Oaks, Roger Staubach ate lunch, then sat on the hood of a car parked beside the coach's dorm. He wore a striped pullover, Bermuda shorts, and sneakers. I had not yet approached Staubach, and I was nervous when I introduced myself and shook his hand. His grip was powerful, but his look was none too friendly. "Oh, yeah, Texas Monthly. They gave me some kind of an award last year. Best wimp." Awkward mutterings. Another reporter wrote that, and besides, I'm just a freelancer and... A Winnebago, brimming with sun-shaded adults and preteen children, pulled close to the curb and stopped. "I've got some friends to see," Staubach said to me, moving toward the motorhome. "The guys in the office told me you were going to be around here this week. I'll talk to you later." I approached him again the next afternoon as he walked from the practice field toward the dressing room. "The Wimp magazine," he said, when I fell in step beside him. But his tone was no longer hostile. "I just don't understand where they got that word. To me, a wimp is some skinny little guy that wears glasses, you know, an accountant. Somebody like Woody Allen." Staubach wiped his forehead with a sweatband on his wrist. "I'd like to talk to the guy who wrote that, and Clint Longley, right after that." Staubach has a reputation for remembering every slight. He understands that he is in the entertainment business, but he is sensitive about his public image. Part of Staubach's image problem derived from the act he had to follow. The Cowboys of the past were lovable losers of the big game. On and off the field, they were flamboyant, colorful. When Cornell Green intercepted Don Meredith's pass at practice one afternoon, Meredith chased him down the sidelines, whooping and brandishing his helmet like a club. Walt Garrison was married to a Dallas heiress, but he really was a cowboy, a rodeo performer in the off-season. Garrison used to leap into rookies' rooms at night and spit mouthfuls of lighter fluid through the flame of a butane lighter. Joey Heatherton hung around training camp waiting for Lance Rensel, who violated so many curfews that one coach finally suggested Rensel set $1,000 tab aside to cover his fines. They were the Cowboys of the 60s, the models for Pete Gent's novel North Dallas 40. It's still a North Dallas franchise, but the Cowboys of the 70s have moved to the suburbs. Last year, when Meredith was inducted into the Cowboy Ring of Honor, he gazed at the slotted dome and said, "I still say it's a funny-looking stadium." Surrounded by state fairgrounds and a black ghetto, Meredith's Cowboys played on real grass beneath the yawning skies of the funky old Cotton Bowl. Upper deck supports obstructed the views of many seats. Blacks in the general admission section behind the end zone screen chanted adulation for their heroes, Bobby Hayes and Mel Renfro, who had to file suit in order to rent a duplex near the Cowboys' North Dallas practice field. All seats are reserved in Irving's functional, drab, and sterile Texas stadium, the parking lot of which doubles as a drive-in theater. Discrimination against black players has diminished. Drew Pearson sells cars on TV. Harvey Martin has his own radio show. Meredith announced his retirement on July 5, 1969, the day Staubach received his discharge from the Navy. Staubach's behavior off the field was not totally at odds with his athletic daring. One day he showed up at the team's executive offices on North Central Expressway in search of Tex Schramm. While Staubach fidgeted, Schramm rocked in his chair, staring out the window, making no effort to abbreviate his conference call. Staubach found a janitor who led him out on a narrow, unrailed ledge 11 stories above the parking lot, then made his point by leaping into the view of Schramm, who gasped, "Oh my God!" and almost overturned his chair. But Staubach was no folksy Southern individualist like Meredith. He first saw Dallas at age 18, when he was on his way to New Mexico Military Institute, which he attended for a year at the behest of Navy football recruiters because he could not meet the English entrance requirements of the academy. The military school in Roswell was not only a prep school for service academy aspirants. Many cadets were the spoiled, unwanted, or problem sons of affluent Texans, and they demanded yes-sir treatment from jocks with northern accents. From that day until he joined the Cowboys, as a cadet, plebe, midshipman, and supply officer, Staubach accommodated the restraints of military life for 9 years. If Tom Landry wanted discipline on his team, Staubach knew all about that.
We've run out of time for this week's show, but Jack will read the conclusion of The Aging of the All-American Boy, Roger Staubach, next week.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear Recording Library.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9. This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Saturday Night Movie.
I have just created something totally illogical.
If you build it, he will come.
If you build what, who will come?
Insane.
I hate it when that happens.
Me too.
Who's hearing voices?
Ray is.
I think I know what if you build it, he will come means.
Ooh, why do I not think this is such a good thing?
Daddy, there's a man up there in the lawn.
This is really interesting.
You believed in the magic. It happened. Isn't that enough?
Annie, it's more than that. I feel it as strongly as I've ever felt anything in my life. There's a reason.
Go the distance.
Did you hear the voice, too? Did you hear it?
Go the distance.
Yes.
Our grave is dead. He died in 1972.
Are you Moonlight Graham?
No one's called me Moonlight Graham in 50 years.
You build a baseball field in the middle of nowhere, and you sit here and you stare at nothing.
This field, this game, it's a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good.
Hey, is this heaven?
No. It's Iowa.
Kevin Costner, Amy Madigan, James Earl Jones, Ray Liotta, Burt Lancaster. Sometimes, when you believe the impossible, the incredible comes true. Field of Dreams.
Catch the audio described Field of Dreams, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 96 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 80s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the upper 90s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 80s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Please note that in order to protect the safety of volunteers and staff and recording services around the country at this time, some productions have been reduced or eliminated. The show that follows substitutes for the program regularly scheduled for this time.
Again, you're swinging down the lane with David Miller. Today, the radio station in the spotlight is WBRH, broadcasting from the Baton Rouge Magnet High School in Louisiana. Once again, it's time for one of those programs in which I reminisce about occasions when I had close encounters with musicians. And I'll start right off with an occasion when I saw Doc Severinsen performing with the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra. You could always spot Doc with trumpet in hand and wearing just about the loudest outfits that were ever shown on television. He had a delicious sense of humor and also played fine trumpet. Let's listen to him as he leads an orchestra in playing an ancient tune titled simply Jada. As I have mentioned from time to time, once I discovered the Big Band Academy of America, that became a great excuse to travel to Southern California for this organization's annual banquet. On one occasion, I met Johnny Catron, who had led an orchestra back in the 1950s and 60s. I developed a warm friendship with Johnny and his companion, Peggy Lafferty. In 1994, he invited me to be his house guest on the evening before the banquet. I arrived at his home in Pomona in time to dine with him and Peggy at a restaurant in nearby Rancho Cucamonga. The next day, he and I climbed into his Rolls-Royce automobile as he took me on a tour of Pomona, including a visit to his barber shop. When it was time to go to the banquet in Studio City, he handed the car keys to me, and I, for the one and only time in my life, sat at the wheel of his Rolls-Royce. When we arrived at the Sportsman's Lodge, we thoroughly enjoyed the program, which included the awarding of the Golden Bandstand to Billy May. His band had always been a favorite of mine, and it was a pleasure to meet him in person before the studio band paid tribute to him. I liked to refer to his reed section as the slurping saxes. I think you'll catch on as to why I use that phrase as we listen to his own band's recording of the tune Charmaine. Thank you. That was the Billy May Orchestra. After the banquet, I said farewell to Johnny Catron, but invited him to visit me in Little Rock. Sure enough, 6 weeks later, he drove the Rolls Royce from California to show Peggy the town of Henrietta, Oklahoma, where he grew up, and then continued on to become my house guest. He brought with him a few dozen audio cassettes featuring broadcasts of his band from a Los Angeles radio station back in the 1960s. Here's one of the tunes in their band book with Johnny himself doing the vocal.
Johnny Catron going to sing for you on our next selection. It's Baby, Won't You Please Come Home.
Now, baby, won't you please come home? You left me all alone. I have tried in vain, never no more to call your name. When you left, you broke my heart. I thought we would never part. Every hour of the day, you can hear me say, baby, won't you please come home? Never part. Every hour of the day, you can hear me say, baby, won't you please come home? Come on home now, baby, won't you please come home?
My college class held a mini reunion in San Antonio, Texas, where one of my former classmates had made his home. My wife and I wandered down to the Riverwalk, which I was aware of because of the long-running NPR radio series Live at the Riverwalk, hosted by Jim Cullum. Sure enough, Jim, the leader of the orchestra, was in attendance. I introduced myself and mentioned how much I enjoyed their weekly radio program. I had intended to sit through their evening concert, but there were some delays which meant that we could only stay long enough to witness a rehearsal for their evening broadcast. Jim was gracious enough to autograph a CD, which gives me the opportunity to play one of the tracks. I've chosen Dogtown Blues, which was recorded during one of their broadcasts when bass player Bob Haggart was their guest artist. On this performance, listen for